from Storyflow. This is your daily audio brief for June 29th. Hey Iris, June 29th. 10 stories, 1 trial, 3 reviews, 6 takes you can actually use. Let's get into it. First, from New Atlas. One nut could be our best chance at saving the Amazon from deforestation. Observational data from the region show that Brazil, nut trees thrive only in undisturbed forest, so when loggers clear land, the trees and the nuts they produce disappear. Because the nuts are the only commercial product harvested directly from the wild Amazon, local economies depend on keeping the forest standing to collect them. The high selenium content and protein make the nuts valuable on global markets, giving communities a financial incentive to protect the trees rather than replace them with cattle or soy. A lack of purpose leads to romantic obsessions. I've noticed something strange. People have never had more freedom to choose who they date, more options, more access, more tools designed specifically to help them find someone, and yet they seem more anxious about relationships than at any point I saw. And remember, people obsess over dating app and finding their person. Some will stay with people they know are fundamentally wrong for them, and they'll know it the whole time, and they'll stay anyway. I've written before about why modern relationships collapse after 6 months, but something I haven't dug into is a different question, not why relationships fail, but why certain people are so consumed by needing one in the first place. And don't get me wrong, the healthy desire for connection is perfectly normal, but I'm talking about the people who make romantic pursuit the organizing principle of their entire life. Every conversation, social move, and even decision filtered through whether it helps them get closer to being with someone. I've been around groups of guys where the only topic was girls, similarly groups of girls where the only topic was boys, and look, I'm not here to police or judge anyone's conversations. Talk about whatever you want, but if the majority of your conversations with the people around you are about finding romantic validation, it's worth asking what's underneath it, because I don't think it's actually about love. We spend years trying to convince the world to love us while spending almost no time learning how to relate to ourselves with time. Every compliment fades, every achievement becomes the new baseline, every relationship eventually stops feeling new if your sense of worth depends on those external inputs. You'll spend your whole life chasing the next hit of validation with diminishing returns each time. I think the answer to the romantic obsession question has less to do with love and more to do with purpose. It's quiet in my room tonight, calm ambient lighting, vanilla candle lit, the smoke rising in slow swirls filling the room. Why? H something warm, rain ticking against the window like a clock. No caffeine today, taking my monthly reset from it. Let's get into this. You cannot be lonely if you like the person you're alone with. Wayne Dyer. Humans need meaning the way they need food and water. But here's what is interesting. The sources of meaning available to people have changed dramatically over the last few centuries, but the need itself hasn't shrunk at all. Think about what life looked like in, say, 1370 or something like that. You're born into a blacksmith's family in a small English town before you're old enough to have an existential crisis about your purpose. Your purpose has already been decided. You will learn the craft from your father. You will make tools for the soldiers, horseshoes for the farmers, blades for the kitchen. Your entire existence is structured around a trade that feeds your family and serves your community. You wake up every morning with a clear answer to the question, what am I for? Or take religious life a few centers. Wise later, a young woman enters a convent in 1650. At every hour of her day is structured by liturgy, prayer, service, community. Her life has meaning that was handed to her and confirmed by everyone around her, by God, by her community, by the entire architecture of the society she lives in. There's an old vacuum or need for any searching, or zoom out further and think about what community used to mean. People lived in villages where everyone knew everyone. You knew your neighbors by name, knew their children, knew their problems, helped with their harvests. There was a social fabric that held piop. But with a density, modern life has almost entirely lost. Now people live in apartment buildings for years without knowing a single name on their floor. The infrastructure of belonging that used to be automatic has mostly dissolved. The shift happened gradually, and then all at once religion weakened. The extended family scattered. Trades became jobs, became careers, became gig work. Villages became cities where everyone is anonymous. The tight communal structures that gave previous generations a ready made sense of place and purpose mostly don't exist anymore, and the need for meaning didn't go anywhere. But the brain found a substitute for a lot of people. The romantic relationship became the new religion, the new source of identity and purpose and belonging all at once. Instead of asking, what am I building, people nowadays are asking, who will complete me? And that is a question that can ever be answered. There's something happening in your mind constantly that most people are completely unaware of. Psychologists call it the self-concept. In short, the more Brazil nuts we harvest sustainably, the stronger the economic case for preserving the forest that produces them. Next, second from the Forbidden Files. Up next, third from Fies.org. The order of species loss alters how grasslands maintain stability, study finds. Grasslands account for roughly 40% of terrestrial ecosystems and are paramount to global food security. Wild grasslands provide food for livestock and habitat for pollinators and act as a carbon sink in the era of climate change. Maintaining the health of native grasslands is a critical component of protecting the human food supply and sustaining biodiversity in the face of rising global temperatures and changes in weather patterns. And then, fourth from New Atlas. Free tent ignites intense twill be ultralight backpacking competition. Hey, so after a couple of years where almost every boutique brand was pushing feather like freestanding tents, the market went quiet. The only standout was a 29 Nas hyperlight model, and then the big expedition rigs took over the headlines. Now a new solo tent has dropped in at roughly 2 LB, which is about half the price you'd see for comparable double wall options. It keeps the classic double wall setup, separate rainfly and a full mesh body, so you still get the breathability and weather protection you expect. What's neat is that despite the low weight, the design isn't a compromise. The rainfly is independent, so you can adjust ventilation without pulling the whole thing down. It feels like a solid entry point for anyone wanting ultralight performance without the premium price tag. If you've been waiting for a more affordable featherlight tent that still delivers the full double wall experience, This one's worth a look. Next, fifth from Inverse Science. House of the Dragon just changed one major thing from the books. There's no question that the Battle of the Gullet was the event fans were waiting for in House of the Dragon Season 3. But there's one event that comes in at a strong second. The Fall of King's Landing, the plot where Lysand attempts to cede control of the Red Keep and the Iron Throne to Rhaenyra and the Blacks without any casualties. That's what we see unfold in Season 3, Episode 2, and it comes with some shocking moments like Helena quickly trying to adjust to her new circumstances and even sent off with the Hagar to Harrenhal. But the episode's final moments are especially surprising and change a small but impactful moment from the books. Warning, spoilers ahead for House of the Dragon Season 3, Episode 2. When Rhaenyra takes control of King's Landing, she's told there's something for her in the dungeons. That's when Otto Hightower emerges from the cell where he's been kept since Season 2. Rhaenyra knows this is her moment to exact revenge on the man who sparked this conflict in the first place, but she refuses to let anyone do the dirty work for her. She's the one who wields the sword and slices Otto's head off without a second thought. This is quite the development for Rhaenyra's character. She's not known for her melee prowess. If she fights, it's with strategy, like when she walked to visit a Lysand from her birthing bed, or from afar on her dragon Syrinx. But here, she's truly come into her own through the grief over yet another one of her sons. In Fire and Blood, the book The House of the Dragon is based on, this goes down a little differently. Sir Otto Hightower, who had served three kings as hand, was the first to be beheaded, the book reads. Iron Rod followed him to the block, still insisting that a king's son must come before his daughter. While this description doesn't outright say who dealt the fatal blow, there are a few context clues that suggest it didn't go down at all like we saw in the show. A block is mentioned, meaning these executions were formal enough to allow for a proper beheading setup, and presumably an executioner, instead of the sudden slice delivered by Rhaenyra. This change highlights the biggest challenge in adapting Fire and Blood for the screen. The book is written like a history text, so characters who play massive roles can be written off in a single sentence. But if Otto's demise was just as anticlimactic in the show, it would be a massive disappointment for fans. So instead, Otto's execution becomes more than just an ultimate end for a major player. Now it's the next step in Rhaenyra's evolution from grieving mother to vengeful leader. Up next, sixth from Manga Bay, Day Farmers Fear Water Woes from Plandalen G-Plant. Suffet Halmchunthit, a farmer in Phantom Sarakam, Thailand, is watching a new 600-megawatt LNG plant being planned just a few kilometers from his 8-hectare farm. The plant's environmental impact assessment says it would need up to 12,000 cubic meters of water each day, about what 49,000 local residents use in a day, according to a 2024 study. His durian trees, now in their fourth year, have already survived a season where irrigation was limited to 15 minutes a day. He also grows cassava, rice, plums, rubber, and rambutan, all of which rely on the same canal water. The district already carries a medium, high drought risk on the World Resources Institute's Aqueduct Water Risk Atlas. Adding a large water draw from the LNG plant could push farmers like Suffet from barely surviving to losing crops entirely. Local concerns are not just about water. The plant is also expected to increase air pollutants, compounding the stress on an area already balancing agriculture and growing industry. And then, seventh from New Atlas, the Puamodi hides a deeper truth about physics, study reveals. A quick look at the piece shows it's not reporting new data, just a straightforward physics observation. The author explains why the Puamodi ends up with that familiar spiral shape by pointing out a basic principle. When an animal defecates, each successive coil drops a bit lower than the one before, so the pile naturally tapers. The idea rests on simple gravity and geometry. No experiment, no meta-analysis, just a logical deduction. Because each loop falls a shorter distance, the overall form narrows toward the bottom, which matches what we see in the emoji and in many real-world examples. The article doesn't claim a breakthrough. It's a modest illustration of how everyday physics can shape even the tiniest digital symbols. It's a neat reminder that even something as trivial as an emoji can reflect the underlying rules that govern how things move and settle. So, if you're wondering why the emoji looks the way it does, the answer is simply that gravity and the way each coil stacks up naturally produce that tapered swirl. No deep mystery, just a clear everyday physics insight. Next, 8th from South Dakota Voices. Struggling to catch up, what can we do? 21% of credit card holders in South Dakota are delinquent on their credit card payments. A high percentage of delinquencies, anything over 13%, means that people who were already struggling to make payments are falling further behind. Specifically, increased credit card delinquencies represent an affordability issue. As prices for essentials like food, housing, healthcare, transportation, and taxes, sales and property and fees take more of household budgets, consumers are increasingly relying on credit cards to fill the gap. The concern is supported by the Federal Reserve System data, which suggests the U.S. is at an all-time high for the amount of consumer debt. It is also interesting to note that the rising debt does not appear to be party-related. There was a problem under Biden, and the problem has continued to escalate under Trump. We have reached the point where families in South Dakota are crying out for help. What combination of actions is the best way to provide assistance? Cut unnecessary government spending, so the taxpayers can keep more of their income. These cuts could provide reductions to both property and sales taxes. Unnecessary spending includes new buildings, new recreation projects, and other costs. Cut unnecessary taxes and fees on companies, so companies can reduce prices to consumers. This would include report filing fees, future fund tax payments, professional and business licensing costs, etc. Make nonprofits pay the same property taxes as everyone else. These companies use city, county, and state services. When they do not pay, the tax load increases for everyone else. Stop forcing taxpayers to fund tax increment financing TAF projects. While these projects are marketed as a positive for taxpayers, they really transfer the tax load to other taxpayers during the period of the tax abatement 10-20-0. Stop allowing tax dollars economic development to create and keep low-wage jobs Smithfield, Schwann's, Manitou, 3M, Tyson's, Ramcota, Dakota Dunes, etc. No one wants these jobs. When they are created, companies have to fill job openings with foreigners who are willing to work well below the market wage. This quasi-slavery not only puts the families from overseas into poverty, but pulls citizens toward poverty line because they are forced to pay for the food, housing, health care, and schooling for these families. The situation is compounded because this practice lowers wages for everyone. Stop competing with the private sector. If the private sector is already doing something, don't enter that business. When the government makes this mistake, profits for the private businesses go down, people lose their jobs, and some businesses are forced to close. Do you have any other suggestions? Up next, 9th from LLM Watch, iAgents of the Week. Papers you should know about. A classical intuition in computer science holds that verifying a solution is easier than producing one. This week, the intuition gets inverted. The verification crisis. The most provocative finding this week comes from the verification horizon, which argues that for modern coding agents, reliably verifying solutions has become harder than generating them. As foundation models develop stronger reasoning capabilities, every reward function we build is merely a proxy for human intent, and optimization pressure widens the gap between proxy and intent, manifesting as reward hacking and signal saturation. This finding casts a long shadow over agent development. If we cannot trust our verification signals, how do we train agents that reliably do what we want? Self-directed learning and data synthesis. Two papers this week explore how agents can improve their own training pipelines without constant human intervention. Autodata introduces the concept of an agentic data scientist that meta-optimizes synthetic data creation, converting inference compute into higher quality training data. Meanwhile, Oppa tackles the sparsity of trajectory level rewards by extracting hierarchical skills directly from an agent's own completed trajectories, yielding dense, token-level supervision that is distribution, matched to the current policy. Together, these papers suggest a direction toward agents that generate the very signals they use to get smarter. Agent-native infrastructure and efficiency. Building agents that work in production requires more than capable models, it demands robust systems underneath. Are we ready for an agent? Native memory system evaluates 12 memory architectures across 11 datasets, revealing that no single system dominates and that localized maintenance is more cost-efficient than global reorganization. For agents to be production-ready, they must be architecturally robust and token-efficient. Dynamic context grounding and adaptation. Two papers address the context gap, the mismatch between what users or environments provide and what agents need to act effectively. Hue, when image agent bridges underspecified image generation requests through a unified framework integrating planning, search, reasoning, and memory. In context, world modeling enables robots to infer world dynamics from a short history of self-generated interactions, adapting to novel camera viewpoints and morphologies without any parameter updates. Both treat adaptation as an in-context problem rather than a fine-tuning problem. Trust, privacy, and human alignment. As agents make more decisions on behalf of users, the question of alignment with social norms becomes urgent. Privacy aligned places human judgment at the center of privacy alignment, introducing annotation conditioned reward modeling grounded in 3,516 detailed annotations from 599 unique annotators. The paper argues that privacy is not a binary classification problem, but a contextual judgment defined by social expectations, and that standard labels are unreliable proxies for the nuanced norms agents must follow. And then, 10th from MD Reports. Germ Games, NIH emails reveal the military strategy behind pandemic planning. Behind closed doors at the World Economic Forum in Davos in January 2016, senior figures from the Gates Foundation and the World Bank proposed a new approach to pandemic preparedness, large-scale simulations modeled on military war games. Newly obtained internal emails show how the idea, referred to as Germ Games, gained rapid momentum and drew in the U.S. National Institutes of Health, NIH. On January 10, 2016, as the NIH director Francis Collins prepared to attend the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos, he emailed an advance copy of his schedule to Anthony Fauci, one of his closest advisors. One session in particular caught his attention. According to Collins' report to Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvie Eberwell, the pharmaceutical companies were blunt about the conditions for their participation. They could not commit to rapidly developing vaccines for every future outbreak unless governments first resolved who would pay and how liability would be handled. This Davos session sounds like a potential landmine, Collins wrote. The meeting, titled Vaccine Innovation for Pandemic Preparedness, brought together executives from GSK, Merck and Johnson & Johnson, along with representatives from the Gates Foundation and the Wellcome Trust. The companies said they were willing to contribute their vaccine platforms, but would not share their commercial intellectual property. Collins described the emerging proposal as very sketchy and warned that it raised serious questions about governance, funding, and strategy. He cautioned against any plan that would undermine existing U.S. programs. A separate session on preparing for future pandemics proved even more consequential. Chaired by World Bank President Jim Yong Kim, the discussion included Bill Gates. Gates argued that the world was poorly prepared for a fast-spreading respiratory virus and that more sophisticated simulations could strengthen planning around logistics, communications, quarantine measures, public messaging, and vaccine deployment. Kim seized on the idea. According to Collins' email, the World Bank president proposed creating Germ Games exercises explicitly modeled on military war games, persuade G20 leaders to invest in pandemic preparedness and avoid complacency once Ebola memories faded. Kim suggested tapping into the expertise of the U.S. Department of Defense, whose war games experience tested command structures, decision-making, and crisis response under pressure. He publicly called on the NIH, the World Bank, the Gates Foundation, and the Wellcome Trust to develop the concept together, saying he would find funds for this. Writing to Fauci afterwards, Collins acknowledged that the proposal had quickly gained influential backing. Fauci, I responded that the U.S. government already had considerable experience running simulated bioterror attacks. He explained that the Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Defense, and the Department of Homeland Security had conducted extensive tabletop exercises, simulated crisis scenarios in which officials rehearsed responses to biological threats, including aerosolized anthrax, militarily smallpox and influenza pandemics. With both the Gates Foundation and the World Bank endorsing the initiative, he wrote, it would be hard to stop this effort now. Collins admitted that large-scale pandemic simulations fell outside his expertise and asked Foss, I, for his assessment. This may not be exactly what Bill Gates, Jeremy Farrar, and Jim Yong Kim were referring to, Foss, I wrote, but it would be pretty close. He also suggested involving Nicole Lurie, then Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, noting her previous experience at the RAND Corporation. Collins quickly looped Lurie and BARDA Director Robin Robinson into the discussion, asking whether support from the World Bank and the Gates Foundation could help upgrade existing U.S. modeling and preparedness work. Lurie replied that HHS was already updating its pandemic influenza plan and had an entire team conducting regular modeling for a range of biological threats, including H7N9, MERS, Ebola, and Zika. The germ games concept did not remain a one-off idea. A year later, Collins returned to Davos for the 2017 World Economic Forum meeting. His schedule included a pilot pandemic simulation organized by the World Bank and the Gates Foundation. That's the read. Small inputs, compounding results. Back tomorrow.